Moat. I'm Tommy McNeil. Worldwide, the number of people who have died from COVID-19 is more than 114,000, while the number of confirmed cases is well above 1.8 million. In the United States, there were more than 22,000 deaths and more than 560,000 confirmed cases. Blood tests for the coronavirus could play a key role in deciding whether millions of Americans can safely return to work and school. But public health officials warn that the current Wild West of unregulated tests is creating confusion that could ultimately slow the path to recovery. More than 70 companies have signed up to sell so-called antibody tests in recent weeks, according to U.S. regulators. Governments around the world hope that the rapid tests, which typically use a finger prick of blood on a test strip, could soon ease public restrictions by identifying people who have previously had the virus and have developed some type of immunity to it. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson was released from a London hospital Sunday after being treated in an intensive care for the novel coronavirus, but the Prime Minister will not immediately return to work, according to a statement from his office, which added that he would continue his recovery at his country residence. Johnson was admitted to St. Thomas Hospital in London a week ago, 10 days after he tested positive for the coronavirus. Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has been filling in during Johnson's absence. The government's top infectious disease expert said Sunday that the United States may be ready to start gradually reopening next month as signs grew that the coronavirus pandemic was peaking. Dr. Anthony Fauci, head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, has quietly sought action to stem infections and said in a televised interview that parts of the country could begin easing restrictions in May. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Christians around the world celebrated an Easter Sunday upended by the coronavirus without the usual crowded church masses and large family gatherings. Instead, they turned to the internet, television, and radio from home to follow services that noted the grave impact of the pandemic. Some found novel ways to mark the holy day. Others still assembled in groups but took precautions to try to avoid infection. The virus forced a change in Easter traditions that had even endured wars. St. Peter's Square was barricaded to keep out crowds, while one Florida church drew a large turnout for a drive-in service in a parking lot. Strong storms pounded the deep south on Sunday, killing at least six people in South Mississippi and damaging up to 300 homes and other buildings in northern Louisiana. Flood and tornado warnings were issued in many parts of the south. One mask producer in China says that it is rushing to fill orders from overseas while facing stricter quality inspections from Chinese regulators. Wuhan Johnson, which makes masks and disinfection wipes, says 50 million in orders from European countries and the United States will keep the company at full production capacity until June. Johnson plans to add another five production lines to increase the daily production from 200,000 to 700,000 masks. Production managers told reporters during a media tour organized by the Wuhan government, Chinese customs have announced that ventilators, masks, and other supplies being exported to fight the coronavirus will be subject to quality inspections following complaints that substandard goods were being sold abroad. OPEC, Russia, and other oil-producing nations have finalized an unprecedented production cut of nearly 10 million barrels, or a tenth of global supply, in hopes of boosting crashing prices amid the coronavirus pandemic and a price war. The group of nations agreed on a video conference Sunday to cut 9.7 million barrels a day to begin May 1st. Mexico had initially blocked the deal. Iran's oil minister also says several Middle Eastern nations agreed to an additional cut of 2 million barrels a day. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange fathered two children with a lawyer representing him while he was sequestered in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, according to a British newspaper. The mother of his children, 37-year-old South African lawyer Stella Morris, told the Mail on Sunday that the couple have two sons, aged 1 and 2, both conceived while Assange was in the embassy and kept secret from media and intelligence agency monitoring his activity. Paper said Morris has been engaged to Assange since 2017. You can find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America and James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 13, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Domestic violence is said to be on the rise during Kenya's coronavirus lockdown.
The measures that the Kenya government has taken to contain the spread of COVID-19, these actions actually create fertile ground for violence against women. When people are isolated in their homes, it puts women and girls at high risk of violence.
Ethiopia's coronavirus restrictions are forcing pregnant women to give birth at home. HIV patients in Uganda say coronavirus lockdown is affecting access to their medicine. Campaigning has begun in Mali's parliamentary runoff election. Malawi's main opposition accuses ruling party supporters of assaulting its secretary general. And remembering the late former Togolese Prime Minister, Edem Kodjo.
He was truly one of the intellectual architects of the economic community of West African states. Beyond that, he rose up to become the Secretary General of the then Organization of African Unity.
Mohamed Ibn Chambers is the head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. Those stories plus Samse O'Malley sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The number of coronavirus cases in Kenya has risen to 197 as most churches in the country held Easter services online. Also, a member of parliament was reportedly arrested Saturday in a bar for breaking lockdown rules. Meanwhile, 45% of Kenyan women ages 15 to 49 say they have experienced physical violence, while 14% say they have experienced sexual assault in the last 2 weeks since the government imposed a curfew to curb the spread of COVID-19. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Underage women are reported to be held captive by adult men who sexually assault them, claiming needed female company to get through the government-imposed COVID-19 lockdown. According to the Human Rights Watch, the Kenyan government has adopted strict measures to counter the spread of the COVID-19 virus, but these measures are having particular impact on women and girls, including increased risk of gender-based violence. Agnes Odhiambo, senior researcher Women's Rights covering Africa, says anytime there is a crisis, violence against women are always on the rise and that the government should look into the matter.
The measures that the Kenya government has taken to contain the spread of COVID-19, the impact is that these actions actually create fertile ground for violence against women. When people are isolated in their homes, it puts women and girls at high risk of violence.
Violence is a daily reality for women and girls across Kenya. In many cases are not reported to authorities and few women get justice or receive medical care. Jen Anyango, a Kenyan activist for peace and for women's and girls' rights from Kibera slums, said that the cases are on the rise, especially in the slum, given the congestion and some families being unable to provide for the children.
The houses are so small for everybody to be in during the day. And because of this, people are in conflict for one reason or another.
The Office of the Public Prosecution in Kenya has said that since the curfew was imposed, they have received rising number of sexual assault cases. And Mrs. Jen says most of the girls, especially in informal settlement, are lured into sexual acts by adults.
Because the children are out of school and most of them are not really at home the way they should be. So mostly the children are convinced into getting themselves into sexual act with adults.
Vivian Mwende, legal counsel at the International Federation of Women Lawyers Kenya, says women should report the domestic violence cases to the authority.
Any cases such as the sexual harassment, such as rape, such as assault, then these cases are going to be heard at the magistrates within 24 hours.
According to the Human Rights Watch, violence against women and girls is a crime and they have a right to be protected even when the government is preoccupied with the pandemic. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Ethiopian health workers say COVID-19 travel restrictions in the country are forcing pregnant women to give birth at home. Simon Monk reports from Addis Ababa.
For Kanasa Kumera, receiving panicked phone calls from women going into labor has become an everyday occurrence. ever since Ethiopia implemented strict travel bans last month to stop the spread of the coronavirus, the Mary Stopes International Maternity Centre he manages in Adama, located roughly 100 kilometres from the capital, Addis Ababa, has received up to 10 calls a day from women unable to reach his centre to give birth. The trend, he says, is of particular concern in poor areas with no ambulances and where travelling even small distances can be difficult. Kinasa spoke with VOA via a messaging app.
This morning, one client has called the head of an ambulance and told that she had two cesarean sections before, and also she is appointed for cesarean section, but she has been suffering due to the shortage of means of transportation, so she asked for an ambulance. I am lately sent her. Now she is admitted, and the third cesarean section is safely conducted.
Kinasa said he was concerned that many other women have not been so lucky and are unable to arrange transportation. They are forced to give birth at home where medical emergencies cannot be treated.
Definitely there could be complications since there is no means of transportation and proper health service provision in the town. No doubt that the complication will happen.
Parliament on Friday approved a nationwide state of emergency, giving authorities sweeping powers to prevent the movement of people. Schools, bars, cultural restaurants, hairdressers and gyms were already closed. On March 23, the government issued orders to public transporters to cease overcrowding. The regions of Oromia, Amhara, Harare and Tigray have banned or restricted public transport to help limit the spread of the coronavirus. Ethiopia has recorded 65 cases. The Ethiopian Ministry of Health did not respond to questions on access to health services for pregnant women. Risha Hess, country director for Mary Stopes in Ethiopia, told VOA via a messaging app that people all over the country were no longer able to reach health services for delivery or postnatal care.
We're able to pick people up and bring them to the hospitals, and so far that's what we've done. If it continues, who knows if we have the, you know, we only have one ambulance at every hospital. So there will likely be people who we can't get to either fast enough or because we don't have the capacity. And I can only imagine what's happening with all the other maternity centers in the country and in those towns.
There are shortages of sexual and reproductive health products from India because factories there have closed and the borders are shut. This, she said, could result in years of problems and backlogs due to the borders shutting down across the world. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
People living with HIV in Uganda say the ongoing lockdown to fight the coronavirus is affecting their access to ARV and other health services. Some volunteers are using bicycles to help deliver drugs for people who cannot access them. Mugumi Davis Rakariji reports from Kampala.
26-year-old William Atovu says he was worried he was not going to get treatment after public transport was banned in Uganda as one of the measures aimed at preventing the spread of COVID-19 8 days ago.
Most of us use public transport access our facilities, which is not in place right now. So I could not move, and my facility is a little bit far from where I stay. I didn't have any solution that particular time because if I miss my dosage, automatically the virus will multiply and the end result could be death.
Usually, Matov relies on public transport to reach a health facility some 15 kilometers away where he gets antiretroviral drugs or ARVs. ARVs are used by HIV patients to suppress the HIV virus and stop the progression of HIV disease. Patients who miss them could be associated with increased viral load and an increased risk of drug resistance. Herman Subuga, an HIV-AIDS activist, says, unfortunately, there are many people in the country currently having difficulties in accessing drugs.
Some this situation for them when they are not at their residence, they visited. Some do move long distance to reach at their facility. Drug has gone out of stock in some facilities. That is also a challenge. And we don't know when this situation is going to end.
Another HIV-AIDS activist, Simon Peter Bukenya, has taken it upon himself to help deliver ARVs. Using his bicycle, Bukenya rides over 70 kilometers daily, making deliveries in various spots.
Most of them, they reach me through that contact. They send me the details or they call direct and they send me their credentials, then I ride to their facilities.
Bokenya himself has lived with HIV for over 30 years and is very much aware of dangers associated with missing out on treatment. He says he has helped more than 60 people since a ban on public transport was announced. Ruth Jane Acheng, Uganda's Minister of Health, says the government has set mechanisms to help people living with HIV access drugs and treatment. She says Kampala Capital City Authority and other district leaders have been asked to transport medication to people living with HIV.
Services for HIV and TB should continue. The differentiated service delivery model must be doubly strengthened to allow patients access their medication in a timely manner.
But HIV activists say some people living with HIV do not ask for help for fear of being stigmatized in their communities. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The main opposition Malawi Congress Party, the MCP, says a regional governor of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, assaulted MCP Secretary General Eisenhower Mkaka. The alleged attack took place after President Peter Mutharika reportedly accused MCP leader Lazarus Chakwera of encouraging violence by ordering his followers to catch and kill people believed to be collecting national identity cards for voting purposes. Malawi Congress Party spokesperson Maurice Mutale says the attack on Mr. Mkaka took place in plain view of the police.
What actually happened was Eisenhower Mkaka went to Area 3 police station in our capital city just to find out what was happening to his friend after hearing that his car and himself were picked by the police after receiving orders from above. When Mkaka was there, David Kambalame came and charged on Mkaka and assaulting him and injuring his eye.
One account we have is that Mr. Mkaka was allegedly beaten after he had gone to the police station to inquire about another supporter of your party who had been arrested by the police. Can you tell us why was this MCP supporter arrested?
Until now, we don't know exactly why David Kambalame, the governor of the ruling DPP, could do that. The friend to Mkaka, as we speak, is now and still in police custody, and he has not been charged of any crime at all. What is worrying here is that the police openly said that they were sent by their bosses from above. And according to them, it was David Kambalame who ordered the police to go and arrest Mkaka's friend. This is very, very worrying indeed, especially that David Kambalame was assaulting our SG in full view of the police.
In a speech last week, President Mutharika accused your party of engaging in violence against supporters of the ruling party for the sole purpose of preventing them from registering for the coming elections. Your comment?
What Peter Mutharika said was very unfortunate. In fact, very laughable and very shameful. A whole president cannot stoop so low to speak or allege that Dr. Chakwera is the one inciting violence. Actually, what we are saying in Malawi Congress Party, and what Dr. Lazarus Chakwera is saying, is that there is no law in this country that requires somebody to surrender an ID so as to access a loan. So we are saying to the DPP that this is a rigging ploy because they just want to reduce the numbers of the people from the stronghold of the Malawi Congress Party and our alliance partners, and then they should also register the minors in areas that they feel they are strong. And that is rigging.
Campaigning for the second round of Mali's parliamentary elections began last Thursday, soon after the country's constitutional court certified the results of the March 29 first round. The second round is expected to take place April 19. The first round took place in spite of the coronavirus pandemic, with the government putting in place measures to protect voters. Yasamaki ran in the first round to represent Mali's largest electoral district of Kati and lost. Now, he says, he is supporting the opposition alliance, including former Prime Minister Musa Mara.
About 22 candidates have been elected during the first round of the election. The other candidate will go to the second round in most of the jurisdictions. We understand that many requests have been made by candidates against the other candidacies, but the court has made its case and confirmed officially the result that were proclaimed.
I know the elections were held on the 29th of March. Was this usual to release the results at this time? And if not, why did it take this long? Was it because of the coronavirus?
The law allows the Constitutional Court to review the provisory results for at the most 5 days, during which the first 48 hours candidates can introduce requests and complaints against the other candidates. For this matter, they have received a number of complaints that they were studying and reviewing and came about with the definitive official result.
You ran to represent Mali's largest electoral district. How did you do?
We have done relatively well. I came third out of seven candidacy. We are very proud of our result, given that we didn't participate in purchasing the votes. We were committed to the democratic values and principles, which would not allow us to buy votes and the conscience of the electorate.
According to the results, it seems the parties that went into the election as an alliance did very well, but you did not. Why did you not go into an alliance?
We were competing against an alliance of the largest three political parties in Mali, namely LPM, ULD, and ADEMA. As you can understand, this is the ruling party ganging with the opposition party against our candidacy. So this was unethical, and it was a breach of our democracy, a threat against our democracy, because opposition is supposed to be controlling the ruling party. But today we see that they're ganging together against the people, against our democracy.
Yaw Samaki was a parliamentary candidate in Mali's largest electoral district of Kati. He was speaking with us from the capital, Bamako. Former Togolese Prime Minister Idem Kojo passed away this past Saturday in Paris at the age of 82. Kojo served two terms as Prime Minister under the late President Nasimbe Iyadema before going on to serve as Secretary General of the Organization of African Unity and then the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. Mohamed Ibn Chambers is the Special Representative of the UN Secretary General and head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. He says the late Idem Kojo was one of the intellectual architects of ECOWAS, who also played a leading role in the liberation of Africa from colonial rule.
The late Idem Kojo is someone who I've come to know as an intellectual, a diplomat, an economist, an elder African statesman whose advice on many issues I always sought. And anytime I was in Togo on official business, I always included him.
Togo's current prime minister described the late Kojo as an ardent pan-Africanist. You served in several diplomatic positions. What can you tell us about him as a pan-Africanist?
First and foremost, he was truly one of the intellectual architects of the Economic Community of West African States. As Minister of Finance, then principal advisor to the late President Iyadema of Togo, he, along with the late Professor Adeniji of Nigeria, who was his contemporary on the Nigerian side, these two were really the brains behind the design of the Economic Community of West Africa States. Beyond that, as you know, he rose up to become the Secretary General of the then Organization of African Unity, the OAU. And in that capacity was the Chief Executive of the leading Pan-African organization of our continent at the time of the struggles for the liberation of the African continent, especially the fight against apartheid South Africa.
Idem Kojo's country, Togo, was in political turmoil in the past few years. Did he play or attempt to play any role in terms of
how to bring about a peaceful resolution to the political crisis in Togo.
Yes, indeed. Late Adam Kojo played his part. As you recall, he parted ways with President Adema and went into the opposition. But in opposition, he was always moderate and always sought peaceful approaches to resolution of the Togolese crisis. And therefore, he was always identified with what became known in Togo as the moderate opposition. It was his nature.
Mohamed Ibn Chambers is the special representative of the UN Secretary General and the head of the UN Office for West Africa and the Sahel. He also served as executive secretary of the Economic Community of West Africa, this ECOWAS. He was speaking with us from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with the indefinite postponement of all the continent's Champions League and Confederations Cup semi-finals indefinitely by the Confederation of African Football, CAF. The continental competitions were already in their later stages as the spots for the semi-final matches across both competitions were taken. Egypt's Zamalek were set to face Morocco's Raja Casablanca, while Al Ahly were supposed to face Wydad Casablanca in the Champions League. Meanwhile, the Confederations Cup, also dominated by Egypt and Morocco, as the first semi-finals will see Pyramids FC take on Guinean side Horoya AC, and in the second game, Moroccan clubs RS Bakani and Hassania Agadir will fight for a spot in the final. Both legs were to take place between May the 1st to the 3rd and May the 8th to the 10th. However, as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread around the continent, CAF have decided to postpone all these encounters. Staying with football news, the 2020 Olympic Games have been scheduled to be staged in 2021 owing to the coronavirus pandemic, but South African under-23 football coach David Natuane has expressed relief in the fact that the age limit for the football competition could be raised. It is reported that the FIFA working group has recommended the age limit could be raised to accommodate the players who will be 24 by the time the games get underway next year. Coach David Natuane believes the pandemic was not anticipated and explains he will take average players for the tournament set to be held in Japan. In volleyball news, the Kenyan Volleyball Federation has called for results of the latest round of African Beach Volleyball Olympic qualification to be annulled due to the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on the competition. The second round of African Volleyball Confederation Beach Continental Cup took place last month. Pool C of the women's event was held in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, on March the 7th, with five teams expected to participate. Democratic Republic of Congo, Cape Verde, and Kenya all withdrew from the event due to the coronavirus outbreak, leaving Nigeria and Zambia to qualify automatically for the final round of the Beach Continental Cup. Five teams were also due to contest Pool C of the men's competition at Banjul in the Gambia on March 14th, but only the host nation and South Sudan participated. Meanwhile, Kenya will pay hundreds of its sportspersons who will be deemed vulnerable from the coronavirus to help them endure the suffering and continue to train. Sports Principal Secretary Joe Okudo on Saturday confirmed that the government will compensate the athletes, especially those who were part of the national team heading to the Tokyo Olympics, whose calendar of competitions has been wrecked by COVID-19 pandemic. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. That's it for this Monday, April 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, hoping you will have a productive week.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.